Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Purdy Insurance. Visit Purdy Insurance on Market Street in Sunbury or visit online at purdyinsurance.com. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. And today's show is brought to you by Purdy Insurance, Market Street in Sunbury. Go to purdyinsurance.com. I don't care if it's auto, home, life, business, whatever insurance it may be. They're going to find you the right coverage that fits you. They're going to also work as hard as they can to find you the absolute best price. And if there's a claim, they jump in as if it happened to them. Because they know, look, you've got plenty to worry about in your plate. They'll take care of that part for you. That's what a great insurance agency does. That's Purdy Insurance, Market Street in Sunbury. Go to purdyinsurance.com. Jerry Dulac in just a few moments from the Post-Gazette. Tomorrow, Jerry Palm of CBS Sports on Bracketology. Nathan Davis, Bucknell basketball coach on Thursday. Friday, Kim Jones, NFL Network. Time now for our play-by-play call of the day. Friday in the Garden.
10 seconds left. Dockage on Carr. Carr looks at it. Crossover. Drives. Backdoor Reeves. Slam dunk Penn State with 2.8 to go.
That was the game winner right there. And again, Dave Jones, he said, did you see Reeves? I said, I could see Reeves. He said, you could see Reeves? I said, yeah, I could see Reeves. First of all, I knew what the play was. You could tell the way they set up, so I knew what the play was, just, you know, based on practice and what Pat called. Again, you have to do the smart thing. We've been in a TV era now for, where more college basketball than ever has been on the air because ESPN's done a great job of bringing it to us over the years. But it's also brought with it commentary over the last 38 years. And part of the commentary has been for a long time, you need a timeout, you need a timeout, you need a timeout. And not if you practice something over and over again. Timeouts are situational. In other words, if Garner goes to the floor, gets the ball, and steals it from Bates Diop. He gets the ball to Julian Moore. All right, so what do you have now on the floor? Were you in a situation where you need to get a guy back in the game offensively? Then you call a timeout. If you really want to button down exactly what play it is, you call a timeout. But if you're in that situation and you've already got the play you want, you've got plenty of time, and you realize, what's Ohio State doing on that play? Ohio State just lost the ball. They're backing up. And they're also in the process of backing up. They're trying to find people. That includes Kata Bates Diop. On the play that Penn State called, it is to send, you know, it spreads out the middle to create the cut by Reeves. One of the guys was Julian Moore, who was on the floor, who, of course, is the one that Garner got the ball to. Moore goes to the corner. Kata Bates Diop goes with him. Why? What, is Moore going to fire it up from the corner to win it? Doubtful. But again, that's why you don't call timeout there when you've got the right personnel on the floor, the right call already made because you practiced it, and then you've got them confused trying to pick up who they're supposed to pick up. That's why you don't always call timeout in that situation. Big one. All right, let's bring in Jerry Dulac from Post-Gazette. Jerry, it's really great to hear from you again. I hope you're doing well.
Steve? I am. It's always good to chat with you, and all's good. I was at the Combine. I am back, and now I'll turn my attention to golf for a little bit, and then back to the Steelers for the NFL owners' meetings, then to the Masters, back to golf. So I'll go back and forth here for a little bit now, and then get ready for the NFL draft.
And then, okay, then I've got a combination of questions. There will be a golf question in here at some point,
That's fine.
As a matter of fact. Let's start with Le'Veon Bell. What's the possibility of him being franchised, and is that really more just to buy time for contract negotiations?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what it is. I mean, they're going to take advantage of that if they have to. And ideally, that's not what they would want because it's just a tremendous cap hit. Whereas if they sign him to a long-term deal, which they say is their intention, obviously the cap hit will be half that at least for the first year. So, you know, you'll take a if it comes to him signing the franchise tag again, well, you're talking about a $27 million cap hit in 2 years for your running back. But that's what it is. They're not going to just let him walk. So they'll use the franchise tag and then hope to sign a deal.
How does free agency play out for the Steelers? Which guys would be on that list that won't be coming back? And then what does that do in terms of what the Steelers need to think about in the free agent market?
Well, I think you will see them let Mike Mitchell go. He's an $8 million cap hit, and I don't think they're in a position where they'll even want him to take a salary cut to keep him. They kind of wanted to do that last year with Lawrence Timmons. They really didn't want to let him go. And they were hoping to reduce his cap hit, bring him back at a lower number, and then he took the bigger offer, not surprisingly, from Miami. But I bring him up because it's very possible that should he be released by Miami, which is what they are saying, that I would not be at all surprised to see the Steelers bring him back, much like they did a number of years ago with Larry Foote, who left for 1 year to go to Detroit and then came back and ended up, because of injuries and whatnot, having to be a starter. And so I think Lawrence Timmons would be brought back with the idea that he could be a starter. He'd be, you know, maybe a backup, hopefully. But if he had to be a starter, they would be comfortable with that until, you know, they could develop an inside linebacker, which will be their priority in the draft. And sometimes, you know, depending on how the board falls, depending on their grades, you know, it might be that a safety goes in the first round and an inside linebacker in the second round. But in an ideal world, I think that's where you will see them address their first pick, number 28, at an inside linebacker.
Okay. Obviously, I've had the privilege of watching Barkley every day for 3 years.
Yes,
you know, practice,
yes, you did.
Games and so forth. Okay, now you had a chance at least to see him in person and also at least the physical attributes. What did you think?
Well, Steve, anything I say will not surprise you because of what you said. You get to see him all the time. Probably first and foremost, and I've known this just from, you know, as you know, I'm a Penn Stater, so watching him from afar, I know what kind of person he is, the way he comports himself, and that's what always stands out to me. He's a bright young man who handled himself very well at the combine between the throng, you know, in front of a throng of national media. And, you know, his numbers were just freakish. I mean, we know about his power clean record at Penn State, and then he does 29 reps, and he vertical jumps 41 and a half, and he comes in a couple pounds heavier, which was the only thing that surprised me, because typically running backs, Steve, at the combine come in 5 to 10 pounds lighter so they could run a faster 40 time.
That's right.
You know, he came in a couple pounds heavier because he said, you know, for a couple days he's been interviewing and sitting around and eating a lot of food. So at 233 pounds, he runs a 4.4, which, you know, at that weight is, you know, those are freakish numbers. And his strength, his quickness, his speed, you know, it makes him, in my opinion, easily the best player in the draft, you know, of all the positions. And could he be number one overall? Well, I doubt it, because I just can't imagine Cleveland. If Cleveland would not draft a quarterback with number one, I think the fans would burn the town down. So I don't see them passing on a quarterback. I don't think Saquon Barkley. I really think the Giants would end up taking him. They do have a need at defensive end, and I wouldn't be surprised if they take a quarterback. But Saquon Barkley won't get past Indianapolis at number three.
All right. Let me break this next one down into two parts. The Browns have 1-4. All right, so
right.
So people have to remember that part. They have 1-4. When you looked at the quarterbacks, Jerry, what were the pros and cons of those quarterbacks as to how you looked at it and how their games translate, you think, to the NFL?
Well, And to your point, Steve, I had this discussion with some of the people from Cleveland about what would be the possibility of taking Saquon Barkley first, thinking that one of the two, maybe you have two quarterbacks equal, and you're going to get one of the two the number four overall. That's a possibility as well. But I think what we will see and what we've already started to see is that despite the number of turnovers, and you got to see Sam Darnold firsthand 2 years ago, but yep. Despite the number of turnovers in 2 years, I think it's become apparent to everybody that this guy has set himself apart as the top quarterback. I think you see some guys like Josh Allen maybe closing in, but I think when push comes to shove, I still think it'll be Sam Darnold will be the first to go, and Josh Rosen will be somewhere, you know, in the top five, maybe two. If the Giants decide they really like him, who knows? But I think that's the way you will see it break down. I just can't imagine under any scenario Cleveland making some type of trade that would allow them to get both Sam Darnold and Saquon Barkley. Of course, that's not just a home run. That's a grand slam. Because right. If Indianapolis would move up, they would only move up to get ahead of the Giants if they suspected that the Giants would take, the Giants might take Barkley. And then if they did that, the Giants might take Sam Darnold, and now the Browns are left without both of them. So that's why I just don't see them trading that number one pick. I could see them trading that number four pick, maybe down a couple spots.
Let me ask you about the college part for a moment, because I do not know how Ben Roethlisberger played at Miami of Ohio against Power 5 teams. I don't. I mean, if I were to say that, I'd be lying to everybody. So I don't know that part. But I do know that Allen, and I saw him play once in person, ironically, Jerry. Someday I'll tell you why I saw him in person. It was no big deal, but I still saw him in person against, of all teams, Eastern Michigan. It was the night before the Penn State-Michigan game. But he only had a quarterback rating of 31.7 against Power 5 competition. Is that something to be wary of, or is it just no big deal on the evaluation sheet?
No, I think it's something to be wary of, just for the same reason that the Steelers love to take guys from Power 5 conferences, because they played in big stadiums, they're used to big games against big competition, better competition, if you will. And so, you know, ironically, Ben Roethlisberger is the only player that they've drafted from a non-major school or non-Power 5 school since 1999, and that's only because he was a franchise quarterback. They just basically stay away from players who don't play at that level of competition and who are comfortable playing in big games in big stadiums. So from a Steelers standpoint, yeah, that would matter I'm not saying that would be the ultimate red flag, but that would certainly get their attention, and I think that would certainly be a factor. To your earlier point, I can't tell you either how Ben played against bigger competition, but I will say this. Ironically, when you look at the three quarterbacks, Eli Manning, Philip Rivers, and Ben Roethlisberger, the first three taken in that order in that draft in 2004, Ben was considered the one who was least ready to play in the NFL. And Ben was the one who came in and proved that he was the most ready to play immediately in the NFL, going 13-0 as a rookie. So sometimes those evaluations of who's ready and who isn't change as soon as they get on the football field.
Who fell into the category for you as a, that was interesting when you looked at him out there at the combine?
I'm trying to think, but maybe a couple of the linebackers. The guy from Boise State, Leighton Vander Esch, who was an inside backer at 6'4", 240. He comes in at 256. He wanted to come in and show the NFL scouts that, you know, you have to be bigger to play in the NFL. So he wanted to come in and test it at a bigger size. And his numbers were unaffected because of that. The linebacker from Central Florida, the kid with no hand.
Griffin,
You know, when you see Griffin, when you see him run like that, it's just so impressive. I look I mean, I'm just trying to think of who might have either opened my eyes. I mean, I'll tell you, but this is no surprise either, because as I mentioned today in the paper that, Mike Gesicki is, he was Saquon Barkley among the tight ends. And you know, Steve, before Ryan Shazier was injured and before Vance McDonald, who they traded a fourth-round pick, last year, developed later in the year, I had even said this to Mike Munchak. I said to him, I can tell you, this was midway through the year, I says, I can tell you who your number one pick's going to be already. He says, who's that? I says, the tight end from Penn State, because at the time, he fit exactly what they needed. Their defense was playing well. They had addressed defense in the previous draft. They don't need any help on offense, but if they did, it would have been a tight end. You know, Jesse James is a nice number two guy, but he's not a number one guy. And you know, his numbers, as you know, with Gesicki and his athleticism, it's just off the charts. And the way he performed at the Combine just reinforced all that. If this guy isn't the number one tight end taken, I mean, to me, he's a first-round talent easily. And his production and his ability, it's exactly what you look for in the NFL. And so his numbers weren't a surprise, but when I see him, he was another one that you go, huh, whoa, those numbers are pretty impressive. Maybe not surprising, but nonetheless, they're still impressive.
Long strider who eats up a lot of ground, so he runs 4.55. I mean, when you watch it, you're like, okay, is he going fast? And then all of a sudden you realize how much real estate he's eating up with each stride. And then the 22 reps to go with his basketball ability, where he understands how to use his body like he's a rebounder on jump balls.
Right. Yeah, and I love the fact, too, Steve, when he was asked about, you know, the 50-50 ball. The combat catch is a big thing in the NFL. There are big receivers who Martavis Bryant of the Steelers is one. He's not a great combat receiver. He's going to run past you, but on a 50-50 ball, that's the best it is with him. 50-50, I'd be willing to say it's more like 40-60. But I love Gesicki's answer. He said, hey, from my perspective, it's 80-20 that he's going to go up and get it. And let's face it, he pretty much goes up and gets it. And he's so athletic that he can make it fall in the way or however he needs to do it. I mean, I just think this guy's a big-time talent, but I loved his response to that, because that's his attitude. If that ball's thrown up, he's going up and getting it.
Okay, I've got to ask you a golf question. Mickelson won yesterday in Mexico. First time in four and a half years he's won since the British Open.
Right.
But he's had a lot of top 10s, top 20s, whereas he's been in the neighborhood. Can you put into perspective, at his age in recent years, what he's been able to do to at least keep himself in the conversation all the time?
Well, you know, he struggled there for those years where he didn't win, and he wasn't. He had some top 20s and a couple top 10s, but he wasn't putting himself on the leaderboard. And you look at his last four starts. He's played 8 events this year. His last four starts are tied for 5th, tied for 3rd, tied for 2nd, and a win. So he's put himself up on the leaderboard, and you knew it was probably only going to be a matter of time. But if you watched him yesterday and you watched how hard he was breathing to control his nerves and his heart rate, he really wanted that. He was very nervous, and I was really glad to see him win. But, you know, at the start of the year, he had a tie for 3rd or 5th, I think, too. So in 8 events, you know, he's finished within the top 6 5 times, and 11 of his last 15 rounds have been sub 70. So he's been playing very well. And, you know, he's a guy at his age who's able to play the way he has, just like with Vijay Singh, because they have those long kind of syrupy swings, Steve. Right. And the kids today, and Tiger's a perfect example, their backs and their knees and everything can't hold up to the violent nature of their swings. Justin Thomas is 25 years old. And I know Justin because I know his dad. His dad was my old pro at my club here in Pittsburgh. You wonder how long, when guys swing like that, how long it can hold up. And the vast majority of guys on tour have those powerful, violent swings with a tremendous amount of torque. And it just beats their back and their core and their legs, but that's why they train as well, so they're able to swing like that. Phil has never had that issue, and that's why through all these years, he's been able to do what he does. He hasn't lost any length, all maybe a little bit, but with equipment, he makes up for it. And yeah, I was just really glad to see it. I was really glad to see him win, and I just thought it was tremendous for golf.
I just want to ask one more quick question, then I'll let you go. I appreciate the time very much. And that goes to, you mentioned how nervous he was, because I watched it as well, and you could tell, and he even admitted, hey, look, he was a bundle of nerves, even though he was trying to act cool on the outside. I remember Jack Nicklaus in 86 when he won the Masters said he had to remember in his mind how to win because it had been a while for him. Is that about what we saw? Even a player as great as Mickelson, as great as Nicklaus was, is that what we were seeing? Yeah, you have to remind yourself how to win.
I don't think there's any question about it, and I think that was part of what you were seeing. And it's not part of that. I think, Steve, is how to control your nerves, how to control your heart rate. Things like that, when you're putting, when you have a wedge in your hand, whatever the case may be. It's usually not a big factor on longer clubs, surprisingly. It's usually a factor when 150 yards and in and on the putting green. So I think that's a big part of what they're trying to do. In Jack's case, it had been even longer since he had won in 86 than it was for Phil. But it's back being in the hunt, and I think you saw that in a couple tournaments this year where he got on the leaderboard, was up there in second, third spot, and then just couldn't finish strong enough. Whereas yesterday he kept himself in there, made those birdies, and was able to pull it out. I think, like I said, I just think it was tremendous for golf. Phil was very popular, and for him to be able to do that, I mean, that now puts him. And he's played well with Augusta since his last green jacket. He's had opportunities to win a couple since he's won three of them, and this puts him right back in the conversation to win another. You know, Steve, real quickly, it is amazing to me. This guy is the second greatest player of his generation and would be the greatest if it wasn't for Tiger Woods.
Right.
It is likely and highly unlikely that any player from this new generation will ever do what Phil Mickelson has been able to do, and yet Phil Mickelson was never, ever the number one ranked player in the world because he played in an era of Tiger Woods. You're talking about guys like Luke Donald was number one in the world. And boy, I'm not knocking Luke Donald, but Phil Mickelson was never the number one ranked player in the world and will go down as one of the greatest players, not only of his generation, but any generation.
You know, I could talk to you for a long period of time. I appreciate it so much, Jerry. It's always great having you on. And not only that, you do such a great job with your own show in Pittsburgh. I appreciate it very much.
Well, thanks, Steve. I appreciate you saying that, and I always enjoy chatting with you. Holler anytime, because I always enjoy the conversation.
Oh, the outstanding Jerry Dulac, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. It's always great to catch up and talk with him. The conversation just could go and go and go. All right, we will come back. Bottom of the hour, we got a little news break coming up, including from CBS News. And final half hour, Matt Leon from Philadelphia. Tomorrow we'll have on the show Jerry Palm, CBS Sports. By the way, Jerry is going to tell you straight out, Penn State's not in. Because, you know, I saw Jerry in New York. I did not, because he had so many people around him, I didn't stop to talk with him at all. But he'll tell you that, hey, look, no on Penn State, which I understand. He's trying to put his deal together and so forth. We had Joe Lenardi on the show on Thursday. But I think this week is going to be important as to watch Texas, watch Alabama, watch Louisville, watch Syracuse, watch Utah. Those are some of the ones you ought to watch to see what they do in their respective conference tournaments. So one of the differences of having the Big Ten first. Nathan Davis on Thursday. Bucknell, of course, playing for the automatic bid in the Patriot in the NCAA tournament at home with Colgate and Kim Jones on Friday. I think if I ask him about Saquon Barkley, it may take up the entire segment before I ask the second question. We will come back with more in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK, brought to you by Purdy Insurance.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Today's show brought to you by Purdy Insurance, Market Street in Sunbury. Go to purdyinsurance.com. I don't care if it's auto, home, life, business, whatever insurance needs you may have. you need to go to the professionals at Purdy Insurance. They're going to take a look at your situation. They're going to figure out what is the best insurance for you so that you are covered. And then they're going to work really hard to find, through various avenues, the best price. Then, if something happens to you, you watch them kick into gear. Look, when you need to make an insurance claim, you got enough on your mind. To have professionals that you can trust and take care of it means so much, and that's Purdy Insurance. Market Street in Sunbury, go to purdyinsurance.com. I'm in the Sunbury Motors studio, Sunbury Motors 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors Kia Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. All right, let's get to Matt Leon, Philadelphia. Going to talk about the Eagles a little bit. I just want to get quickly to Penn basketball because Matt does announce Penn games. Split over the weekend, Yale-Brown, they beat Brown, right?
That does sound right.
All right.
Should have been a sweep, but split had to do.
Yeah, it had to do because they beat Brown the second game, right?
Yeah, they lost a heartbreaker Friday night at Yale in a really bonkers game.
Yeah. All right, so they lose a heartbreaker, Penn does, to Yale, but then they bounce back. Because, I mean, the Ivy, everything's back-to-back all the time. What does it tell you about their character? Because Brown actually at home is a pretty good team this year.
Yeah, it tells you they're resilient. And if you've watched this team throughout the season, it's really not a surprise you've seen them. I don't know that they've had a loss that ripped their guts out like that one did. It was that type of loss where I think somebody I saw put up that with like 50 seconds left, Yale's probability to win was like 1.7%. So a lot had to go wrong on top of a lot going wrong to lose that game. But you know, they've lost, they've been blown out a couple times this year. They've lost tough games, and it's never lingered. And this one didn't linger as well, as they were up, I think, at 1.22 on Brown. It did get a little dicey down the stretch as Brown made some ridiculous three-point shots and kind of tried to do what Yale did as far as extend the game as much as they could, and they ended up getting within six. But you never had that feeling in your gut like this one could be in trouble like you started to get at Yale.
Right, yeah. All right, so now the Ivy League tournament is coming up, but it's at the Palestra. Well, I was impressed about the Harvard thing, was every seat was taken when they played in that thing. So what does it mean for them playing in that building, especially with the tournament there?
I mean, they ran the table at the Palestra in Ivy League play. They were 7-0 at home, so you kind of start right there that they played well at home all year. But, you know, when it came to league time, when it came to money time, they beat everyone. They get Yale. They get a rematch with Yale in the first round. It'll be tough, but I think they've shown they are the better team than Yale. They beat them solidly with the game they played at the Palestra in early February. And then if you watched that game Friday night, they played better. They just couldn't make the plays late to right. close it out. And so you got to figure they're going to go in with a little chip on their shoulder, too, with something to prove. If they're fortunate enough to get past Yale, then probably get Harvard in the championship game. Harvard gets Cornell in the 1-4 matchup. Frankly, I was surprised Cornell got in. They're kind of a flawed team. They don't do much defensively, but they do have a couple of kids in Matt Morgan and Stone Gettings who can absolutely light it up on any day of the week. So there are a couple of kids that it is not crazy to think could score 60 between them in a game, and that could be enough to pull an upset. I don't think they're going to do that against someone like Harvard, but they do have that potential. So I mean, it's all set up for them. I mean, you know, it's being played at the Palestra.
Yeah.
It's right there in front of them. They know that. You know, they realize the opportunity they have in front of them.
Yeah, and the Ivy League determines its champion in the regular season, but the automatic bids determine with this tournament right here. So, all right, I want to ask you a little bit about the Eagles for a second. What do you think how do you look at the Nick Foles situation with them? Because a lot of things are going to be determined now in the next couple of weeks. How do you look at that?
I look at it as a great situation for a front office that is very good at extracting value. When I say that, you've got a franchise quarterback in Carson Wentz. I think pretty much everyone that isn't an internet troll is in agreement that Carson Wentz is a franchise quarterback.
Right.
And then, oh, by the way, you also have the Super Bowl MVP. and the Super Bowl MVP is under contract for another year. And there are a lot of teams that would love to have Super Bowl MVP, but if you don't trade him, he is not the type of guy that is going to cause a problem if he's not playing. He completely understands his role. So I am completely open to moving him, and I think in a perfect world, you probably should move him because you're going to get 400% on the dollar than you would have gotten at any other time trying to move a Nick Foles. But if teams try to lowball you and try to play the, well, you've already got Wentz and you're not going to play him and you should give him to us, bro, then I say, fine, we'll keep the Super Bowl MVP on our roster. He'll probably start the season for the first month until Wentz is ready, and you go from there. So they're in a great spot when you're the defending Super Bowl champs and you've got two elite-level starting quarterbacks. I don't know, honestly, if Nick Foles is elite-level, but you could certainly sell it that way given on the postseason.
Yeah.
And, you know, you wait, and whatever you determine that value to be, whether it be a first-round pick, a second-round pick, two firsts, however you judge it, I would be very comfortable holding the line until I got something remotely close or very close to what I wanted. So they're in a great spot.
Give me an idea on who would be on the Eagles list that might not come back through free agency, and then what the Eagles might look at in free agency to then set up how they draft.
It would be very surprised if Trey Burton's back. Not that they don't want him back, but I think he is going to be probably the most coveted free agent out there from the tight end position. Young, athletic, has shown he's a pass catcher.
Yep. And he wants to play more. And he wants to play
right,
more.
Right, and, you know, deservedly so. I mean, he's proven that he's, I think, a starting tight end, and probably a top half of the league starting tight end, especially when it comes to pass catching. A little tight on the cap, and I would imagine some team is going to pretty much blow him away. And it's going to make really, really difficult for the Eagles to try to match. But you've got Zach Ertz. I don't know if Brent Celek comes back. He might retire. You know, he's been in the league a long time. And what better way to walk away than with a Super Bowl? Now, that's not based on any inside information. That's just kind of, yeah, you know, looking at the landscape. They'll probably need a tight end of some sort, a number two
right.
tight end. Past that, you know, 20 of 22 starters locked up coming into the season.
Right.
You know, LeGarrette Blount, I think he wants to be here.
Yeah.
I don't know that they necessarily need him, although he was very productive, especially in the postseason.
Right.
If he wants to come back at a number they like, you know, I'm sure they would love to have him.
Yeah, how are they in the cap at this moment?
They're pretty tight, and they might actually, for the moment, actually be over.
Okay.
I'm not a capologist. I don't dig real deep into that, but some stuff I've read, until, like, the new cap number is set and you kind of, you know, you get people like Donnie Jones, the punter, retired. So that, you know, you haven't cleaned all that type of stuff up yet. But they're pretty tight. But, you know, even when things weren't so good in Philadelphia, the one thing Howie Roseman, the GM, could do was he could manipulate that cap to the hilt. So I don't worry too much about, oh, they're not going to have the money to do X, Y, and Z. I think they are very good at knowing what their plan is and finding the way to get there.
Always a pleasure, my friend. Good luck with the Ivy League tournament this week. It should be very entertaining, and maybe you've got an NCAA in your future. I hope you do.
That's the one thing on the bucket list I've never done, so that would be fun.
Well, it would be, believe me, you're in that tournament, you're looking around at that tournament, just sitting at the press conferences, and you're sitting at the open practices, and you're looking around, yep, in the big leagues. We will come back and wrap it up in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
There are a lot of places to get insurance coverage, but only one place in the Susquehanna Valley ready to put four generations of experience to work for you. Hi, I'm Adam Purdy. At Purdy Insurance, we take the time to talk with you and find the right coverage for your needs. Everyone's situation is unique, so our approach is to customize coverage to best protect you. Whether it's home, auto, or business insurance solutions you need, call, email, or stop in to see how our commitment to personal service can help protect what matters to you.
Well, I feel like we've overcome the early disaster on the show today. And you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, we're off to a strong start here this week. Off and rolling.
Yeah, the first couple minutes where I kept getting texts from this individual, about IndyCar season starting this weekend?
We'll deal with that in May.
I'm not even sure we'll do it then.
Right.
You know, it's interesting. You know, watching the tournament play out, and you watch Michigan had to play 4 games, 4 days. Purdue played 3 games, 3 days. Penn State played 3 in 3 days. You know what I noticed in watching how the tournament played out? The guys that had legs were mostly the older players on all the teams. Now, I was thinking about this as I was driving back from New York yesterday. I kept thinking, well, gee, look at Rockman. Rockman looked at like he was, you know, like it was Thursday. Wagner looked like it was Thursday. Duncan Robinson looked like it was Thursday. Shep Garner looked like it was Thursday. Dakota Mathias looked like it was Friday because they didn't start till Friday. It was interesting, the younger players, and Carson Edwards is a good example. Carson Edwards was dynamic against Rutgers on Friday night. I was at the game. Carson Edwards obviously was great against Penn State on Saturday. But what didn't he have yesterday? He's only a sophomore. He didn't have his legs yesterday. And you could see it on his jump shot. His jump shot just wasn't the same. He didn't have... And Carson Edwards is the kind of guy that does a lot of running. Now, if I knew I was going to get the ball, I'd be running too. But he does a lot of running. Well, guess what? You could see that his legs weren't quite the same. And it made me think of this, and I see this in football, obviously. You got to think of this in basketball, too. That additional strength and conditioning cycle means a lot, especially at this time of the year. Shep Garner's been through 4 of them now. You could see he had his legs. He had everything on Saturday. Carson Edwards, you know, or Dakota Mathias. Dakota Mathias, the senior. You could see he had great legs yesterday playing 3 games in 3. There's no issue. Rockman, senior. It was interesting. The older players who had been through multiple strength and conditioning cycles were the ones that had no problem at all handling an alleged fatigue in the tournament. So now we're going to get to this part. All right, how it's going to play out. Now, wrestling's got the week off before we get to next week, and then they go to the NCAAs in Cleveland. So I'll have Jeff Byers on the show next week. Have Brian Tripp on today talking about hockey. So this week really is going to be a lot about the combine. Troy Apke ran a 4.34 today. Whoa. Mike Mayock liked him to begin with. He loves him even more now. Apke really helped himself today by turning and cranking out that time, but I'm not surprised because Troy is not a good athlete. Troy's a great athlete. But now the combine's over with. This is going to be a basketball week, so what are you going to watch for? Let me give you a couple teams before Selection Sunday that bear deep watching by you, a fan filling out a bracket. And how deep you want to send each team will be up to you. But take a long look at Michigan. As you know what, I think it was on Wednesday. Did I say Wednesday or Thursday that I picked Michigan to win the tournament? If it's not going to be Penn State, I thought it would be them. I think I said it Wednesday maybe. All right, and there was a reason for that. And the other one's Cincinnati. Let's start with Michigan. Michigan has always been an excellent offensive team for John Beilein. Once he finally got his players in there that fit his style, fit his system, because when he first got there, a lot of square pegs, round holes, and you could see it. All right, but then he started getting players in there that fit how he wanted to play. That's always a big difference. And Michigan has always been really good offensively, and they've always been a tough out in the NCAA tournament because they play a little more complicated system offensively than some other teams. They are not an easy team to get ready for in a quick turnaround. They're just not. They're not an easy team to get ready for in a quick turnaround because of their offense. But here's the difference with Michigan this year. In the last 9 seasons, the highest, best, okay, adjusted defensive rating for Michigan was 49th in the country. That was their best. This year, they're 6th. Their defense is not good. It's really good. Remember, best they'd been previous 9 years, 49th. That was the best. This year, they're sixth. To go with a team that already runs really good offense and a little bit, again, in the tournament, they become an issue for somebody. Like, in a short period of time, okay, now we got to get ready for this and figure it out. That's not easy. The other team, Cincinnati, which had a great one yesterday at Wichita State. Cincinnati, under Mick Cronin, has always been not just good, an outstanding defensive team. But now, they got Clark. They've got Evans. And, of course, the transfer who came in a year ago, and he played against Penn State last year, Washington out of NC State. Now Cincinnati plays offense. They're number two in adjusted defensive rating, which is normally the neighborhood mixed teams are in. Right now, the only team that has a better defensive rating than Cincinnati does is Virginia. And Virginia can lose by 30 points in the opening round. They're still going to be the number one overall seed. But Cincinnati's going to be a team that bears watching in your bracket. That's a good win for them yesterday at Wichita State. Also, I always talk about how every season brings on its own personality. They're all different. Let's take Archie Miller at Indiana, who's the head coach. And by the way, I thought Archie Miller did a very good job at Indiana this year. Do you realize last year at Dayton, he made a run to the Elite Eight? Let me ask you, Sean, where do you think Dayton finished in the Atlantic 10 last year?
I'll say ninth.
No, better than that. But they were fifth.
Okay.
They were fifth in the Atlantic 10 and made the tournament as an at-large, and they got to the Elite Eight. They finished fifth in the Atlantic 10. This year, Archie Miller goes to Indiana, and they finished tied with Penn State for sixth in the Big Ten, and they're not going anywhere. Think about that. You were fifth in the Atlantic 10 last year, and you got an at-large. You're tied for sixth in the Big Ten. You don't get anything. I don't think they're getting an NIT bid either. Isn't that amazing? The part about this is that with Penn State, I'll just make a quick... I already talked about it in my conversation along with Dick Girardi with Bruce Rasmussen, who heads the selection committee, which we found to be illuminating, instructive, and so forth. Remember what we said about Penn State's schedule all season, that the schedule was backloaded with their toughest games at the end of the year, right? You know, Penn State went 8-5 in those games. We want to talk about a team playing its best basketball in the last 6 to 7 weeks of the season. That's Penn State, despite the fact that at one point they didn't have Reeves for four games and they haven't had Watkins down the stretch. They still went 8-5. Playing the toughest part of their schedule over that same span. Now, is this enough to get them in? Look, realistically, okay, see what Texas does in the Big 12. See what Louisville does in the ACC. See what Syracuse does in the ACC. See what Utah does in the Pac-12. And see what Alabama does in the SEC. If all of them go down right away in their opening round games, the window of opportunity opens wider for Penn State. But if they win in advance, the window then shrinks. We'll see. Great to have you with us today. Brought to you by Purdy Insurance. Mark and Street in Sunbury. Go to purdyinsurance.com.
You're listening to News Radio 1070 WKOK Sunbury. You can hear us anywhere in the world with the Sunbury Broadcasting Corporation app.